All right, we might get started. Good morning, everyone. My name's Natasha D'Souza. I'm from Ernst & Young's General Insurance Practice. Today, we have a presentation called The Long-Term Consequences of Workplace Injuries: Insights from HILDA Data. Our presenter is Michael McLean. He's a statistician at Finity. Please welcome Michael.
Thank you, everyone. So today I'm going to be talking about the long-term social and economic costs from workplace injury using the HILDA data. I'm going to be attempting to identify a causal relationship between workplace injury and some of the costs we see associated with workplace injuries. So I'll talk a bit about the costs, about indirect and direct costs, and I'll talk about the HILDA data survey. Then I'll talk about what are the predictors of having workplace injury to start with, and then talk about how we estimate causal effects, and then draw together some conclusions. So this is actually one of two presentations this conference which look at HILDA data, so which is great. But we're raising awareness of HILDA data, which is I think an underused resource in this context. You might have been at Hugh and Laura's talk yesterday. If you haven't read their paper, I recommend that one to you as well. They've drawn out some very nice insights from the HILDA data too. If I kind of condense it down really to two key questions about what I'm trying to do with the HILDA data, I'm trying to understand how does risk of workplace injury vary by risk factors? And the second question is, what are the causal effects of those workplace injuries? These are two related questions. The first question has implications for the second one, but the second one is really the heart of what we're trying to get at today. So if we think about costs of workplace injuries, we can think about these in two categories in terms of direct costs and indirect costs. Direct costs, the costs due to treatment, rehab services, wage replacement, things like that. And scheme actuaries will have a good understanding of these already. You'll know exactly what the costs are. What I'm considering here are more the indirect costs. So these are costs that are not borne by the scheme itself. They're borne by workers, their families, by firms, and broader society. So if you think about individual workers and their families, having a workplace injury is a significant event. It can lead to lost earnings. You can miss out on chances for promotion if you're not at work. Your skills can atrophy if you're not using them, if you have time away from work. There could be other factors involved there. There's the cost of loss of health and well-being, which are all born, and it's resultant stresses on family units that go along with those injuries. Those costs are borne by workers and their families. For firms, individual companies, that there's lost productivity, there's having to hire extra workers, things like that. And for society more broadly, there's utilization of social welfare systems, health systems, and other costs which are potentially not captured within schemes themselves. So, and it's these indirect costs which I'm considering in this study. And at the heart of it is a causal question. So, really trying to get to the point of being able to understand a causal link between the workplace injury itself and all of these outcomes, all these indirect costs. So we can't simply take the workers who have been injured and look at what happens to them subsequently, because we actually need a valid counterfactual control group against which we can compare those outcomes. So, and the problem with that is that we never observe the counterfactual. So we can't, if I think about it in this kind of scheme here, I might have two workers. They suffer a workplace injury, and then we can observe what happens to them subsequently. But we can't simply compare that worker against either all other workers or the population or all the other workers in a workplace. What we want to do to be able to make a causal inference, a causal finding, is to be able to rewind the tape and replay it under different circumstances. We can't do that, obviously, so we have to resort to kind of statistical and econometric methods to be able to construct those valid counterfactual scenarios against which we can compare. So there's a number of studies which have been done internationally and a few in Australia on this particular topic, trying to identify causal links between workplace injury and subsequent outcomes. There's a few findings from the states. There's the themes tend to be consistently finding that there are negative impacts on employment and earnings. So there's a few studies from the states, Canada and Europe, which have found these type of effects. They can be substantial, several thousands of dollars per year in earnings less, or quite significant portions of earnings, and these effects can persist for a long time. Similarly with employment impacts, I mean, it is no surprise that these impacts exist, but some studies have measured them to be quite substantial in their magnitude. And there's broader consequences as well. There's increased mortality, family breakdown, use of social welfare systems, things like that. There's a few studies in Australia which have looked at particular transition points, say at the point where statutory benefits cease and people may end up on social welfare, things like that, or use of health services. But there's no real kind of population level causal study in Australia that I'm aware of. Similarly, we haven't really got a good sense of what happens in terms of other outcomes, such as general well-being or impacts on household budgets, health expenditure, out-of-pocket expenses, things like that. So there's a few things that are really not well understood, which I'm hoping to get some insights from the HILDA data for. I'll skip that one. So the HILDA data, Household Income and Labour Dynamics in Australia survey, which is a long-running longitudinal survey. It's been going since 2001, so it's 25 waves so far. It's about 15,000 people per year. It asks a whole range of questions, so we have a very, very rich data source which covers all aspects of household life. Particularly as it relates to income and labour, work and finances and expenditure. So there's a massive amount of information there we can use. Shown briefly there, the number of or the rate of people who have been reported a workplace injury over the various waves there. So it includes data which asks respondents about if they've been off work and on workers' compensation benefits in the past year. And from that, we can identify people who've had a workplace injury. And based on the number of days off work, we can classify those into simple or complex injuries or serious injuries. So you can see about 1% of people have reported a time off work due to workplace injury. And that's the blue line, the orange line over there. That includes all injuries, all workplace injuries, and the blue series there is injuries for which they were away from work for 30 days or more. So they're going to be more serious, severe injuries. There's a range of outcomes that we can measure. I've listed them all there in the table. These cover three broad domains, if you like. There's ones relating to labour force, employment and participation in the workforce. There's ones relating to income and wealth. So that's both for an individual and for households, and also for health and well-being measures. So we have a large number of things to look at here, and the reason I've included a large list there is because we can get at particular aspects of how the workplace injury affects some of these broad categories. So is it drops in income because people aren't working as much, or is it because they have a lower hourly rate, or is it because for other factors, if they missed out on promotion and so on. In terms of household wealth, are households able to kind of cover for some of that shortfall? So we can compare a number of these measures and get quite a nuanced picture of what's happening. So first of all, the first question I started off with was around how does the risk of workplace injury vary across all these other risk factors? So the first part here is a model of those two indicators I mentioned before of whether you've had any time off work or if you've had 30 days or more off work due to workplace injury. So we have a number of, I've put all of the potential risk factors I can identify from the HILDA survey into this model, which predicts that outcome. A mixed model which allows for a kind of appropriate panel data setting. So, and there's a number of interesting insights here, and I suppose all I want to get out of this particular model is just to demonstrate that there's quite a lot of heterogeneity in risk of workplace injury. I'll highlight a few of the interesting findings and predictors here. The first ones I've included here relate to occupation and industry. So you can see the... Sorry, this screen is a bit small, I can't see. So we've got some of the usual suspects of particular occupations, so manual sort of occupations involving trades, factory work, things like that. So on the left-hand side, you can see just to explain the chart. So the coefficient from the regression model is on the x-axis here. So a higher value means you're more likely to have a workplace accident. Lower value means less likely. So it's really these ones where you've got typical sort of blue-collar workers, whereas managers and professionals was the reference category for this one. So they're down the bottom. So as you'd expect, people who are more sort of office work, white-collar worker, have lower risk of workplace injury. Over on the right-hand side, you can see the list of injuries there. Industries. I suppose there's no real surprises there. The ones up the top are where the high sort of typical high-risk industries. All the way down to the bottom where we've got the kind of low-risk ones, insurance and financial services at the bottom, so that's all of us, which is good for us. So there's a wide kind of heterogeneity in workplace injury risk here. There's a number of other interesting risk factors as well, so I've selected a few miscellaneous ones here. The ones on the left-hand side are all the health risk factors, so you can see there's a number of categories where the health status of the respondents is kind of predictive of future workplace risk, injury risk. So smokers are higher risk. Self-reported health, this is an interesting one. So people who have, and this is in the previous wave, so a time-lagged effect. So if you've indicated previously that you suffer, you'd rate your own health as being poor, or less than good, then you are a higher risk of workplace injury, whereas people who rate their health as excellent have a lower risk. So that's an interesting finding, I think. There's a number of other factors over on the right-hand side, a selected range of indicators which demonstrate the heterogeneity in workplace injury risk. So you can see it varies a lot. So I think interesting thing there, so things like union workers have a higher rate of workplace injury. Again, this is correlational, so it's not causal, but potentially to do with the nature of the jobs that unionised workers are involved in, CIFA index, things like that. So if you live in a lower socioeconomic postcode, then your risk subsequently is higher as well. So there's a lot of interesting, I think, nuance there around kind of identifying who are the people at more at risk of workplace injury. So that's kind of the first question. But the second question is really the most important one. This is around sort of, I'll skip back to this one, identifying a causal effect. So to do this, the method I'm using is called the difference in difference estimator. So this is a well-used tool in the econometrics kind of toolkit. for identifying causal assumptions, causal effects. It has a very long history. It's been used since even way back to Victorian times even. But you may have read in the newspaper the typical example is, David Card is a Nobel Prize winner from a few years ago who used it to look at the impact on minimum wages in the states by comparing if you change the legislation in one state, I think it was New Jersey, compare it to Virginia, and we look at the difference over time, what's the impact on the causal impact of that change. So the logic is fairly simple. So if you think about in my pre-treatment group, I've got two groups of people or candidates, whatever it is, and even though they may not be directly comparable, what we're doing is looking at how things evolve over time. And so that control group in the grey, we think about that one there, we're using the trend over time to be able to form a expectation for the treated group in the blue. So if you think about the trend there, where if we applied that same trend we observe in the control group to the treatment group, we take the same trend from that left-hand point, apply it to the treatment group, and we get an expectation of where we should be in the post-treatment period. That's the dotted line. But what we actually find, what we actually see, if we that's the solid blue line, we might observe something different. So that difference is what we interpret as the causal effect. So it's fairly simple. That's the typical sort of canonical 2x2 setup. There's been a lot of methodological advances in recent years to extend this out to beyond the standard 2x2 framework. This parallel trend assumption, as we call it, may not hold. So what you are doing in the control group, we may not expect the trend to actually evolve parallel. We can actually condition on a lot of other covariates to be able to normalise for that effect. There's some other nice kind of statistical properties related to double robustness, which I go and describe in the paper. We can also extend it out to multiple time periods. So this is just considering two time periods, but we have a setting here where we've got a long-running panel survey. We've got multiple time periods. So what we can actually do is do individual 2x2 comparisons for all the combinations of calendar year and the year in which you had a workplace injury. So that's kind of how the effect works. Now, if we look at some results here. So what we're doing here is we're aggregating up all of those potential 2x2 combinations in the data. So for every year in which somebody has a workplace injury, we're then looking at each subsequent year, actually pre and post, and doing that an individual difference model on that particular combination. So we end up with one estimate for every combination of year in which the injury occurred and calendar year. We can aggregate all of those together to arrive at an overall average treatment effect, and that's what we can see on the page here. So to explain how this works, we've got six actual models for each outcome indicator. The reason for that is because we're considering all workplace injuries. That's the, and we're considering workplace injuries for which you were off work for 30 or more days. So you can think of these as all work injuries and severe ones. And we're also considering men and women separately. So I've done a separate model for just men and just women, and one for overall. So altogether, there's six comparisons to look at. So the left-hand chart there is looking at all the employment outcomes. So the yellow series is for just looking at the unemployment rate itself, but the blue series is a second indicator which considers employment, unemployment plus marginal labour force attachment. So two different outcomes kind of getting it to labour force participation and employment. So the way to read it is the causal effect is the what's measured shown on the x-axis here. That's what we've measured from our difference in difference model. And the dots representing the value with the confidence intervals around it. So as a rule of thumb, where the confidence intervals include zero, we can't really conclude with much certainty that the effect is significant. But if the confidence intervals are all away from zero, then we can conclude that that's a significant effect. So you can see there is a bit of an uptick in unemployment and marginal attachment to the labour force. And with more severe injuries, as you'd expect, there's a greater effect. So you can see it's a couple of points for all injuries. So this is an additive effect. So if your starting unemployment rate was 3%, an extra 2% measured here means you've gone from 3 to 5. So those effects are bigger, up to potentially 10% for, 5 to 10% for some of those more severe injuries. The other couple of employment-related indicators I've considered are sick leave and income support. So there's not really strong evidence to say that there's an effect on the number of days of sick leave that you're using. In fact, it could be potentially lower. You could be potentially using less sick leave, which is slightly different to some of the other studies which international studies have found. But there is a significant impact on income support. So this is the extra average amount of dollars that people are receiving in income support. So not compensation, but unemployment or disability benefits. So that's quite substantial there. So you're getting up to 500 to 700 on average for some of those groups there. So that's an overall effect. Another interesting way that we might want to consider this is the dynamic effect over time. So previously we just aggregated everything down into a single number to express a single average treatment effect. But here we're aggregating it into the time since exposure to the time since the workplace injury. And this is important for a couple of reasons. One is because it gives us a very useful diagnostic to check some of the assumptions under our causal model. But secondly, we can see if these effects persist over time or if they just self-correct or if they end up back dissipating. So here you can see for the unemployment or marginal labour force attachment result. Here we can see what we want to see with the red dots is no trend. We want to see that the treated group and the untreated group, and by treatment I mean exposure to a workplace injury, we want to see no discernible trend in that group up until the point at which the workplace accident occurred. And from then we can observe time trends. So you can see that some of these groups here, the effect emerges pretty quickly after the workplace injury and persists over time. So particularly the top right graph, which shows their effect for women for all workplace injuries. So you can see it effects kind of elevates over the next first couple of years, but seems to persist over time, which is unfortunate. Similarly for the men for more serious workplace injuries, we can see the effect then persists over time for quite some number of years. Similarly for income support payments. So again, we're looking at the effect over time. So the red dots are prior to the workplace injury and the blue dots are post. Again, for the top right chart, which is for women for any workplace injury, we're seeing a persistent and even an increasing trend there in the likelihood of, the average amount of income support payments. Similarly for men with serious workplace injuries, that effect kind of is fairly strong and instant and seems to sort of persist over time. So these don't appear to be kind of resolving themselves. The second broad category is relates to wages and income. So here we've tested a number of different aspects of income and wealth. So we can see kind of the impact on hourly wages. There seems to be an impact for more serious workplace injuries. So it's not just that people are working less, but the amount of money they're paid per hour of work has decreased as well. I think that's interesting to consider. It's not just the fact that they're not at work as much, but they don't get paid as much. So they could be missing out on promotions. They could be having to retrain as a different occupation to the one they were initially doing prior to their injury. But the effect seems to be just on hourly wage as well as total income. So there's a number of income measures in the second chart there, which look at total amount of wages, total amount of income. So you can see there's a significant effect there on wages and income and household wealth. So the third panel is about household wealth. So it doesn't seem to be as much of an effect when we consider wealth among households in total. So even though there are impacts on income, that potentially there is some ability for households to be able to adapt, it appears to be. The other indicator was early super access. So this was considering the case if people have been on benefits, but they may expire at some point and then need to dip into their super. So it doesn't appear to be a huge impact there. It's a small and significant, but it's only 1 or 2 percentage points. It's interesting to consider, again, the effects over time. So if you consider the wages in the left-hand chart, so you can see the average effect for wages seems to persist over time, in fact, to get worse. So you can see that ends up being about up to $20,000 per year lower because of the workplace injury. Effects for income are slightly smaller in terms of magnitude. So this suggests that the compensation is acting to cushion some of that effect on wages, but it doesn't do it completely. So there is still a gap even after the compensation on income. And as you'd expect for more serious injuries, it's more severe. It seems to be more severe for men as well than for women for serious injuries. So the last lot of indicators relates to health and well-being. So there's a number of indicators here. We're looking at hospital utilisation. So the HILDA data collects information about overnight and day hospitalisations. It includes information about household health expenditure and about your own self-reported health status. So in terms of hospital usage, this is important to consider in terms of are there spillover effects in terms of health service utilisation that aren't being covered by workers' compensation. There appears to be an effect for overnight admissions, particularly for women. There's a small impact there, so that's about an extra between, I think, 0.1 hospital and 0.2 hospital visits per year. There doesn't seem to be an impact on health expenditure. So this is out-of-pocket expenses for health services. So that doesn't appear to be impacted by workplace injury. Health scores are as well. So we see a drop in self-reported general health overall. That's the yellow bar there at the top right chart. So that's this is on a self-reported health scale. It takes a number of health-related questions and compiles them into a single score from 0 to 100. So we're seeing about two points lower in general for general health and for mental health as well. So the effect seems to be more significant for women for severe injuries. So it's an interesting dynamic here where the self-reported health differs quite a lot between men and women for both general and mental health. And if we consider those over time, this is an interesting finding here, I think, further illustrates that difference between men and women. So for general health, you can see there for men, there's a sudden drop, which seems to revert back to normal. But the trend appears, I think, a bit later for women and becomes worse over time. And that's particularly strong for the severe mental health scores, so the severe injury mental health scores. So there's something going on here. I think it's an interesting thing to potentially explore more. why there's such a different shape amongst men and women. Is it related to occupation? Is it because of the particular occupations that tend to be over or underrepresented among men and women? Is it related to caring? I think there's some interesting questions that probably need to be followed up on this. So that's a lot of charts and a lot of results, but I think overall, these are slightly sobering and depressing results, just all the indirect costs that are being borne by workers themselves and their families because of workplace injury. All these are hidden costs which aren't being, for whatever reason, schemes are not able to cushion completely. To be honest, I was expecting it to be slightly worse going into it. I was expecting to see a much worse story. So in terms of the magnitude of the effects here, I think it's potentially good that it's not as bad as I was expecting. But still, that there are, particularly for income, there's some very substantial numbers there, some really substantial costs that are being borne by workers themselves. I think it highlights the importance of having a whole of system perspective. If you're involved in scheme design, I hope this is useful. It's not necessarily that schemes should be preventing any spillover or any other costs on other parts of the system, but you need to know what they are to do good scheme design. In terms of the long-term nature of it, I think this again highlights the need for there to be a long-term perspective for injured workers. I think some of those effects we're seeing persist for up to 10 years post-injury. So there's really a long-term persistence there which we need to think about. The gender-specific responses I think are interesting. There's potentially more to explore there. Highlights, I think we need a one-size-fits-all approach isn't appropriate. And also, of course, prevention first focus. I probably don't need to convince you all, but I think that there is a lot of heterogeneity in workplace risk, workplace injury risk that we've seen there. And so I think it's very, hopefully this is useful for helping identify particular cohorts of workers that potentially need extra help. If I think about things like they're finding about your pre-existing health condition being an important risk factor for workplace injury, that's something to explore more, whether that's simply mental health or whether it's mental or physical health. That's something to think about as more. I've potentially just scratched the surface, I think, of the HILDA data. There's potentially a lot more to explore. So if there is any interesting other findings, aspects of the data that you want explored more, I would love to get your feedback. Thank you.
Thanks, Michael. There are a couple of questions. Was any consideration given to using broader data sources beyond HILDA, such as the ABS PLIDA dataset, given HILDA is a relatively low number of observations, while ABS data sources provide a larger population to work with?
Yes, I think PLIDA would be the next obvious place to look. Is this on? I'm not sure PLIDA includes information which can identify workplace injury. If it does, then yes, that would be an excellent next step to consider. Yes.
And the second question, how did you handle confounding variables within your causal analysis?
So within the difference in difference estimation, there's ability to include covariates in that step. If we think about back to the graph where we've got the two trends happening and we're assuming a parallel trend, what we can work into the analysis is some more sophisticated ways to account for non-parallel trends using covariates. So covariates are included in this analysis. So all of the ones which we use in that first model are included, all the typical ones you would think about in terms of demographics, age, gender and occupation and industry.
what it... I'd refer you to the paper I've referred to in the paper, the Santana and Callaway 2021 paper, which describes the particular way in which that happens. But the short answer is, yes, we have accounted for all of those differences. So the, for example, the one where we saw women having a much higher hospital utilisation, we can rule out that that's simply just having pregnancy and children, because we've accounted for all the like-with-like comparisons. So we've accounted for age and gender and all those other covariates. So that has been accounted for.
Are there any other questions? Yeah, please use the mic if you can.
Thanks. Great presentation. I kind of follow up on the covariate kind of one is around like, do you have, I guess I'd like to hear your thinking around in the context of causal inference analysis, like the role of potentially like latent confounders, like the things we haven't measured, and if there are any good ways you've seen in like estimating the potential or the probability or the size of one of these latent covariates and how that might be able to, might change interpretations.
Yep. So one thing a very useful diagnostic is that pre-trend, pre-treatment trend. So if we don't see any kind of time trend in those red dots I was showing before, that's a useful indication that we haven't got that unmeasured confounder problem. We don't have a violation of that pre-treatment non-parallel trend. In terms of situations where you do have unmeasured confounders, so a couple of things to say on that. One is that instrumental variable methods are a good approach there. The second one is that a sensitivity analysis is the best way to do it. So to intentionally drop out some of the covariates, which I haven't included here, but would be a good thing to do, is to intentionally drop out some of those covariates that you know do confound the result. So when you do that, does the resulting causal effect that you estimate, how much does that vary by? So if you dropped out a very important predictive variable, such as it could be occupation, and my causal effect, you know, changes by X percent, we know that that's the limit kind of range that you're operating in terms of the impact of that unmeasured confounder. So that's very helpful to be able to say, well, yes, maybe there are some unmeasured confounders, but it would have to be more important than occupation for it to invalidate my results.
Thanks, Michael. Agree. That was great. Cam Lucas from WorkSafe Vic. Given the implications or the practicality of application towards scheme design, did you try and test things by state? Like, was there any attempt to...
Yes. So state is a variable in the model, but I haven't specifically looked at state. I think that would be probably the obvious next step. So there's probably some particular states at particular points in time. If there's particular ones you're thinking of, let me know. We can look at that. But so state is accounted for, but I think there's another level of detail to get into in terms of looking at particular states, particular times. So if there's particular reforms that happen at some point in time, what's the effect of that? So yes, that would be the obvious next step to do.
If there are no more questions, can we please thank Michael for a very interesting presentation.